back to another edition of Woods and Water, South Carolina. I think winter has finally poked its nose in the door here in South Carolina. It's kind of chilly out there. I'm probably sitting on a deck with a cup of hot chocolate looking for deer. Kind of cheating. I won't shoot one off the deck, but it's nice to go out there and look at one, especially when you're so close to the house. You can go in and get warm, which tells you what kind of whitetail deer hunter I am. But welcome in. You're listening to 94.5 WGTK FM here in Greenville, South Carolina. And it's going to be a best of. I took some time off this weekend, going to take the family out to the farm and hang out, spend some time together. So in the next segment, because this one's going to be really quick, we're going to hear a recording I did back in the 4th of July show with Sammy Davis, Medal of Honor winner. Only fitting, being that it's Veterans Day, that we plug in something like that. And it's a good interview. I really like the man. And he's got a great story. And then in the third segment of today's show, we're going to listen to a segment I did last November with Brian Grossman from Quality Deer Management Association about how to take a good outdoor picture. So I hope you'll enjoy it. Sometimes I enjoy going back and listening to some of the stuff I've done before. So be a kind of a best of show today. Be back again next weekend. But in the meantime, I do have two events for you on the calendar, which as always is brought to you by Visit Anderson and Green Pond Landing Event Center. If you want the South Carolina Waterfowl Association, November the 17th, night before duck season dinner and auction. It's being held down in Pinewood, South Carolina at their headquarters. And of course, it's the raffles, the dinners. It's a lot of fun, but you get to look at the education center. You know, Ed Paul comes on here and talks about Camp Woody, Camp Loophole. So we'll get that. That's November the 17th down in Pinewood, South Carolina, at SCWA headquarters. And if you're interested in high school fishing, on November the 18th, which is next Saturday, the Palmetto Boat Center High School Tournament Trail is going to Lake Hartwell, Green Pond Landing. You know, they'll blast off about, safe flight's probably going to be about 7:10 or so. And middle school and high schools, they'll weigh in about 1:30. Middle school, 3 o'clock high school. So it'll be something good for you to do. That, again, is Lake Hartwell Green Pond Landing Center. And a quick first segment on this edition of Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. If you've listened to the show for any length of time, I have a wide variety of guests on here, not only from the outdoors, but from other walks of life. And you know also that I like to travel. And one of the trips I took was I went down to the National Rifle Association Convention in Atlanta, Georgia, a few months ago. And wouldn't you know it, you walk around a corner, something catches your eye, and you meet someone like Sammy Davis. And if you don't know who he is, you've probably seen him on your TV. But we'll save that for the end because I want everybody to listen to what he has to say, and then we'll tell you where you've seen him. But, Mr. Davis, welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina. It is an honor to have you on the show.
It's an honor to be here with you, brother. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're a busy man. I mean, when we talked, you told me you 200 days a year on the road speaking.
Yes, sir, at least 200 days a year traveling and speaking, trying to encourage America to stand up and take part in America.
Which is one of your, and I don't mind starting off with this, it's one of the tabs on your website. It's called The Promise. And
yes, sir.
It'll make you tingle. It's really, it gets to you that much, especially if you're a patriotic type American. Take just a minute and talk about The Promise.
Well, The Promise is what all of us feel in our heart, that we need to stand up and take part in our country. For all those who have served our nation in the past, it's one of the debts that we owe them. That's what I feel in my heart. So that's one of the reasons why we're on the road 200-plus days a year, traveling and trying to encourage America to stand up and take part in this great nation. And that is part of the promise that we can do this. So let us all accomplish that.
You are a Congressional Medal of Honor winner. In fact, we're coming up on almost 50 years. November 18th, 1967 was the date you went in 1965. And just a year out of high school. But you come from a long line of military servicemen. You know, your grandfather in the Spanish-American War, your father in World War II, brothers in Korean Vietnam. Was there any question in your mind about whether you were going in the military or not?
Oh, no, sir. I knew I was going to serve. That's why I wanted to, as soon as I graduated from high school, I joined. They couldn't get me in until September 28th. So I had a whole summer there to, I went to work in the oil field.
Oh, wow.
Made lots of money and got really physically in shape.
I bet you did, because you didn't start out at the top. You probably started out low man on the totem pole.
Definitely started out low man on the totem pole.
Well, take us through, I mean, I don't know where to start asking you questions about what happened. If you would just take it and tell us the story of that battle, that 2 hours of your life that's almost 50 years ago now.
Well, sir, there were a reinforced heavy weapons battalion of NVA and 42 artillerymen. Now, we did have segments of infantry, of our infantry around us, but there were only 42 artillerymen. And the enemy decided that they were going to take our howitzers away from us, our 105 howitzers away from us, and we decided that we weren't going to let them. So they hit us at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's when they started mortaring us. And after the mortaring lasted for half an hour exactly.
Okay.
It started at 2 and ended at 2:30. And I remember that because I looked at my watch when it started. And then all of a sudden, I mean, it was very intense mortaring.
Okay.
And then at 2:30 exactly, it quit. And I looked at my watch again and go, wow, 2:30 exactly. Well, that told me that it was a real timed thing that, you know, that something was going to happen. And then sure enough, from across the river, that's when we seen all the movement and the people shouting, you know, GI, tonight you're going to die. So,
so we got ready. So all this took place at night.
Yes, sir. 2 o'clock in the morning.
2 o'clock in the morning. Now you were you were a mortarman.
Artilleryman.
Yes, sir. And you fought them off with the artillery. You fought them off with a regular rifle, machine gun.
Yes, sir.
And they teach you to do all that in basic training. You put together, you did everything they taught you how to do all the way through, didn't you?
Most certainly. Reinforced the belief that that's what they teach you because you're going to need it. And we did.
Now, they came at you from two sides. Was there, in your mind, I guess, I don't know if you were too busy to think about it, in your mind, was there ever a thought that we're going to lose this?
Well, I don't remember thinking that we're going to lose. I remember thinking that I probably would not survive the night simply because that's where the main force was coming across, was right in front of my gun. So I thought, well, but I'm not going to quit trying.
Right.
Because I knew if I quit trying that the guys that were further behind me wouldn't have a chance either. So that's why I did my very best. I did for my brothers what I knew in my heart they would do for me.
And you were wounded numerous times, numerous places.
Yes, sir. I was blowed up, burnt, shot. But you don't lose till you quit trying.
That's right. And that was one of your, when we talked to you in Atlanta, you had a saying that you told me and my daughter Taylor, and that was what?
You don't lose until you quit trying.
That's it.
No matter what you're faced with in life, truly, you don't lose until you quit trying.
You're right. You're so right. And you of all people would know because you keep trying.
Yes,
now,
sir.
There's a, you know, besides being wounded, staving off attack from, you know, the North Vietnamese, you don't swim.
Oh, no, sir. I knew how to swim.
Oh, okay. But you were wounded too much to swim.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. My back was broke. My ribs was crushed on the right side. My body wasn't working well. That's why I thought, well, if I get the air mattress, you know, blow it up and take it across, that at least I can get across and get the guys back. So that's what I used, was an air mattress.
Why were the Americans on the other side of the river from you? Was that
like that was our infantry
on the front
guys
lines?
were over there doing their job. Normally, when infantry is sent in to protect the artillery, it's okay. It's one of the great jobs. That means they can, you know, cool out for 4 to 6 hours or whatever.
And okay.
Get a little bit of rest, because normally the enemy don't mess with the artillery because we've got big guns.
Right.
But that night, that's what they wanted, was those big guns. They wanted to load them on the sampans and take them into Saigon for what would be Tet of 68.
Okay. Okay. Now, so you're all the wounds you got, you blow up an air mattress, you go across the river, you bring 3 American wounded men back.
Yes, sir.
You found another gun, howitzer to use, and you kept on fighting.
Yes, sir.
For 2 hours.
Well, actually, they didn't break contact until about 8 o'clock in the morning was the last contact that I can remember having with them. And by 9 o'clock, we were getting dust-offs in to get our wounded out. So it was actually a few more hours than just two. The 2 hours were extremely intense.
Okay.
And then the rest of the night was, the enemy was still doing their job.
Now, explain to us what a dust-off is, because I know as a history fanatic or whatever what a dust-off is. Well, what's a dust-off in the military terms?
A dust-off is when the helicopter comes in to pick up your wounded, and they were able to, because of the intense fire, they weren't able to come in before almost 9 o'clock, as I remembered. And when we started bringing those in, well, naturally we put our most wounded.
Sure.
Most severely wounded that were, but still we thought they were going to survive, you put them on first and get them out to get them to the docks, and then the last ones that you put on are the ones that were killed in action.
How many men did y'all lose that night?
With the infantry and everything?
Sure.
I've never sat down and counted, actually, but there were way too many.
Way too many.
Almost all, every one of the artillerymen were wounded. Now, we didn't lose any artillerymen.
Okay.
None of the artillerymen was killed, but unfortunately, a lot of our infantry brothers were. So,
how long did you stay in the hospital after that battle?
Well, they sent me to Dong Tam, and from Dong Tam, they sent me to Japan, and that's where I kind of woke up.
Okay.
Realized that, wow, I was in Japan, and they said that they were going to retire me from the Army, send me home and retire me from the Army because of my injuries. And I told them I didn't want to be retired from the Army. I wanted to go back and be with my brothers. I didn't even know the name of it then. Now I know I didn't have closure because I passed out loading my brothers on the helicopter, and they just picked me up and put me on the helicopter and sent me out. So, but General Westmoreland interceded on my behalf and allowed me to go back to my unit. And as soon as I could walk, I could go back to my unit. So,
wow,
and I got to go back just after New Year's.
Of 69?
68.
Yes, sir. Wow. Well, how long did you?
Of course, I still had lots of. I had packing in my wounds, and so I couldn't do my job as an artilleryman. That's when my captain made me a cook.
Made you a cook?
Yes, sir. Because I could only stand for just short periods of time, and my first job as being a cook was slicing the homemade bread that the cooks would stay up all night baking bread so the kids could have something hot and good to eat in the morning. And they gave me the honor of slicing the bread. And as they would come through the chow line, I would give everybody the bread. That was my first job. And that was about as long as I could stand. Then I'd have to go lay back down again. And of course, had all kinds of antibiotics in me because I had infection.
Right.
All through my body. I got hit by beehive.
Oh,
you know what
wow.
Beehive is?
Yes, sir. But go ahead and tell everybody else what it is.
Oh, it's little arrows, inch to inch and an eighth long, and about the diameter of a pencil lead, and they look like little arrows. They got 4 fins on the back of them, and that's one of our weapons. and it's extremely effective. According to the Geneva Convention, you can only use a beehive round when you are in imminent danger of being overrun. And with what happened that night, we felt we were justified in firing it. Well, the guys in the gun behind me, they thought I was dead. Blowed up and everything. So
right.
And the enemy was all around, so they started firing the beehive over my position. And that's what woke me up when the beehive hit me, because I'd been blowed unconscious.
Okay.
And when the beehive hit me, that woke me up, and that's what started the process of me seeing what was happening, because I was right on the river. So the enemy were coming up out of the water and right there.
And how old were you when this all took place?
I was 21 years old. I had just turned 21 on November the 1st. With all the things that I dreamed when I was younger that I'd be doing when I turned 21, that was not one of them. But
right, sure.
I did the best that I could, best of my ability.
And to those of us who have never served, it's so foreign. I mean, you'd like to think you would do it in that situation, but you never know until you're that situation what you'll do.
Well, that's a fact. I did for my brothers what I knew in my heart they would do for me. And that's what that was the prayer that I kept telling myself and the man above, sir, just let me do my job. Sir, just let me do my job. And he kept his word, and I did my job, and I'm still doing my job.
You are. You retired in 1984?
Yes, sir.
And so for the last, 30-some-odd years, you've been supporting others, still doing your job.
Well, trying to encourage America to stand up and take part in itself. That is the promise.
You just gotten back in off the road, and when I talked to you Friday, you were headed out to a National Guard unit that was fixing to deploy.
Yes, sir.
What did you tell those young men and women?
You don't lose till you quit trying. Go out and do your job, guys and girls.
And you do that?
I answered a lot of questions, because that's what I opened it up to question and answer.
Right.
And, of course, had some really unique questions, and I gave them my answer. I opened up my heart and let them look in.
What would be a question that opened up your heart and let them look in? Putting you on the spot. Well, that's
yes,
all right. You were awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor in 1968, is that correct?
Yes, sir. November the 19th, 1968, 1 year and 1 day from the action.
And that was by President Lyndon Johnson.
Yes, sir. That's the footage that you see in the movie Forrest Gump.
There you go. I knew we'd get around to it. I didn't know if you'd have to bring it up or I'd have to. And that's what I say. You've seen Sammy Davis on your television screen. If you're like me, it was on most of the week. I forget what channel it was on, but Forrest Gump was running back to back to back. And I had to tune in and watch. Because when you see Forrest Gump or I can't remember the actor now.
Tom Hanks.
When you see Tom Hanks receiving the Medal of Honor, that's actually you with Tom Hanks' head on your body.
Yes, sir. That's a fact. They just put my face, or Tom's face, over my body, over my head.
Did you know they were going to do? Go ahead.
Son, those are your knobs on the back of your head.
A mother always knows.
Yes,
did you know they were going to use your footage?
The Pentagon called and told me. And when they first called and told me, they said, well, there's a production company here that wants any and all film footage that we have concerning you. And I said, well, really? Well, what are they going to do with it? Well, being it's a movie production company, we're taking for granted that it's going to be involved in a movie at some point. And I said, well, what's the name of the movie? Well, we don't know. And it took about, 2-3 months before we got all the information. And finally, they called and said, well, it's the movie is going to be based on the book Forrest Gump. So I immediately went out and bought the book and read it. The book is not like the movie.
Okay.
The book did not make my heart feel good. But when the movie came out, they had realigned the book, and the movie makes me feel very good. And they definitely used, you don't lose till you quit trying.
Yes. And the difference in the movie and your situation is you actually swam the river to rescue servicemen on the other side and brought them back across. Forrest Gump stops on his side of the river.
Yes, sir. That's a fact. That is a fact.
Interesting little thing, and it says here in 2005, your medal was stolen out of the trunk of your car?
Yes, sir.
And you got it back a few days later?
It was gone 3 nights, 4 days. And that was a long time period, because I felt I'd let my brothers down because I had allowed my medal to be stolen. But the police department in Indianapolis, Indiana, came forth, and they worked 25 hours a day, and they got it back. It was gone 3 nights, 4 days.
What does that medal mean to you? I mean, you've got the Medal of Honor, Silver Star, and 2 Purple Hearts. What do those represent and mean to you?
Well, it means I did my job to the best of my ability. The Medal of Honor is the honor, duty, honor country that is in all of our hearts, and that's what that represents. It, the love and brotherhood that all the military shares.
What would you say in closing to anyone listening who is listening to this and would like to go forward? What would you say to them?
I want to encourage everyone to stand up for what you believe is right in your heart. And I'm not talking about political alliances. I'm talking about America. To correct the problems that's in this nation, it takes all of the American people working together and all of us standing up firmly for what we believe is right in our hearts. And we don't lose till we quit trying. So God bless everybody, and happy 4th of July.
Mr. Sammy Davis, it has been an honor. I am so glad I looked back over my right shoulder in Atlanta and saw you, met you. Thank you for taking a few moments that day to talk to my daughter, Taylor. She's talked about you often since then. Thank you for taking time out of your day to be on Woods and Water, South Carolina. I'm honored and absolutely speechless in my respect for you, sir.
We'll give Taylor a hug for us.
I will do that. Thank you. God bless you, and keep you safe.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Fall is here. Deer season's in full swing all across the United States. I ran across an article that I think is just pertinent to this time of the year. Ways to ruin a great hunting photo. I'm a photog hack. I take thousands of pictures, and once in a while I get a good one. But reading this article, I look back on some of the pictures I'd taken deer hunting and all, and I said, gosh, look at that background, or you should have done this. So, read this article. I said, I'm just going to reach out and make a phone call. So I got a hold of Brian Grossman, the author of the article in the QDMA magazine. Brian, thank you for taking time to be on Woods and Water, South Carolina.
Thanks, Roger. I appreciate you having me on.
Yes, sir. Well, take just a moment. I like to do this for every guest that comes on the show. Introduce yourself, what you do at QDMA, and maybe just a minute about what Quality Deer Management Association is all about.
Okay, yeah, great. Well, I'm the communications manager for the Quality Deer Management Association. And basically what that entails is I handle most of our social media.
Okay.
We're very active on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I handle most of our website content as well. We have a lot of articles, over 300 articles on our website, and which is, you know, where you came across the one we're talking about here today.
Right.
And then I also assist with writing and editing and laying out our magazine, Quality Whitetails. So that's kind of what my job entails with QDMA.
Do you ever get time to hunt it with all those duties to do?
Oh yeah, yeah. We definitely we make sure we carve out some time to hunt, because you know most of the people involved with QDMA, sure, obviously we're there as a nonprofit. We're there because that's our passion.
Right.
And so yeah, we certainly make sure we carve out some time to get out in the woods.
And, you know, before we get on this article, you were just at the National Youth Hunt that QDMA sponsors every year. A minute about that. What is, I mean, is that first time youth hunters that y'all take to a very special place, or how does that work?
Yeah, it typically is. It's our National Youth Hunt put on once a year in South Georgia, and we choose 10 kids. We have kids nominated from across the country,
okay,
by our QDMA members. And we go through a selection process where we'll choose 10 of those kids. We bring them in, outfit them with lots of gear, just provide them a tremendous opportunity.
Right.
They receive shooting instruction from the Army's marksmanship unit. So some of the top shooters in the country are teaching these kids how to shoot. We're teaching them about all aspects of deer hunting and processing their deer. And of course, all the safety issues that,
sure,
that go along with hunting. And then we take them out and let them hunt. And, it's typically a pretty successful hunt. We had, 10 hunters and ended up harvesting 10 deer, 2 wild hogs and a coyote. So,
wow.
So they had a great hunt this year.
that's a really good hunt, especially,
yeah,
first deer hunt out. That's great. And, commendable.
Yeah, and you did ask, most of these are, as part of the selection process, we do want to focus on kids,
right,
that have typically never had the opportunity to hunt, and you know, maybe in a situation where they otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to hunt. So that's who we focus on, you know, getting involved.
And I'm sure they get a big dose of conservation at the same time.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Well, look, I ran across this article. It's, reading through it, I look back at some of my own pictures and I think, could have done this a little different. Boy, that point right there. Yeah. The first point you make in this article is something I see all the time. And I know why it happens, because, you know, wow, you get down on the stand, you go to the deer, and you put that gun down on the deer and you stand behind the deer and you didn't keep it safe. That's the title of the first one, because that gun is pointed right at you. Take just a second and run through that first point.
Okay. Yeah. This is one that I guess in the past, I typically hadn't noticed all that much until I came to work for QDMA.
Right.
I hadn't paid a whole lot of attention to that. But you know, as part of my job with QDMA, I get to work with and look at a lot of pictures, especially dealing with social media. We have a lot of people send pictures into us.
Right.
And a lot of these, of course, are youth and oftentimes with their first deer. And yeah, nothing is worse than getting in an otherwise great picture. Mm. You know, you have a kid with his first deer, big smile, so much excitement, and you look and his rifle's pointed right at him. You know, unfortunately, we just can't use that. We,
right,
can't, you know, promote unsafe practices, and of course, that's, you know, violating pretty much the cardinal sin of,
right,
of gun safety.
Yes.
They'll always keep that muzzle pointed in a safe direction. So,
and you see, and
yeah,
you
just,
go ahead, and you understand why it happens. I mean, it's exciting,
oh, yeah,
time,
yeah,
and you're not. Specifically focusing on the safety issue. The gun's probably unloaded, you know, or has a dead round in the chamber or something, but you understand how it happens, but you see it a lot.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it is, like you said, there's a lot of excitement, in that time, you know, you're getting the kid back there behind the deer, you're congratulating them, you're setting the picture up and you just prop the gun up against the deer, not even, you know, paying attention to the fact that it's pointed at the hunter, or maybe pointed at someone, you know, next to the hunter. And it's an honest mistake, but it's just one we have to, you know, we have to recognize and try to avoid when we're setting up a hunting photo.
You know, it's, hunting is not a catch and release sport, like fishing is or can be. And you know, the act of shooting a deer or whatever, getting that picture to be tasteful is something a lot of people don't think about either. And that's the second point you write about in this. Take a few moments. How do you clean up a picture and make it, you know, not, I know between hunting buddies, it doesn't make a hill of beans difference, but to friends or non-hunters or people who are kind of in that segment of society that are, that like hunting because they realize it's a conservation tool, you eat what you shoot and all that. What are some of the things you need to do to get that picture more acceptable to society?
Yeah, and that's exactly, you know, why I included this point in the article. You know, amongst hunting buddies, we all know what we're doing out there as far as hunting. We're taking the life of an animal. We know that blood is involved and blood is spilled. But, you know, especially with social media today, you put that picture out there and thousands, even millions of people can see it in a short amount of time. And a lot of those people are not hunters. And you know, over 90% of those people or the population in general are not hunters. And we depend or we rely on those, that portion of people that, you know, that are not hunters, but they still support hunting. You know, we depend on that for the future of our sport. We have to have their support. So yeah, we want to keep our photos tasteful for those that'll be seeing it. That, you know, like you said, they it's not that they don't support hunting, but they're not hunters themselves. They don't want to see a bloody photograph of a deer on their Facebook feed. So yeah, we just need to take a few minutes before we take the picture to just clean the deer up a little. If its face is bloody or the impact area of the deer is overly bloody, you know, take a paper towel or a rag, wipe it down a little bit. I even learned a trick over the weekend.
Okay.
Just rubbing some dirt on those bloody areas. Mm-hmm. Does a good job of covering it up. You know, put the tongue back in the deer's mouth. And just, you know, take a respectful photograph with the deer. Like I said, try to clean up the blood. You know, don't sit on the deer's back or pose it in some way that, you know, is disrespectful.
Yeah.
To this animal.
And, you know, this time of the year, there's tons of leaves in the woods. You know, you could always use a leaf.
Yep, exactly.
The next one I love, tell us the next point, and it's one that that I look back on some of my pictures and think, boy, you could have done this a whole lot differently.
Yeah, I'm the same way. The next point was you didn't keep the photo natural. And I wrote it for exactly the same reason you're saying there. I look back at a lot of my old hunting photos and, you know, the deer's in the bed of my truck all bloodied up. Or it's in the floor of my parents' garage, you know, where I'm getting ready to process the thing. I just didn't take the time to get a good field photo, and I certainly, you know, regret that now. So, again, going back to, I know when, you know, when you harvest a deer, the excitement's there. You're kind of getting a rush to, you know, get it dressed and get it out of the woods, especially if it's, I always seem to kill mine, you know, last light in the evening.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you want to get the deer home and get it processed before it gets too late. But it's just a matter of, again, taking a few minutes like you did to clean the deer up and just get some good shots in a natural setting there where you killed the deer. If you can't do that, at least when you get it back home, try to get it out in the yard or somewhere with kind of a natural backdrop.
Right.
And take a few minutes to get some good pictures.
You know, I look back.
No,
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you know, you'll definitely be glad you did in the long run when you look back on those photos.
Yeah, the first buck I ever killed was a little 5-point. I think I was, I don't know, 16 or 17, because we didn't have a lot of deer in South Carolina, you know, up to the late 70s, because the restocking efforts here in the upstate. And I have two pictures of that deer. And part of it's, you know, back in that time, cameras weren't everywhere. You know, everybody didn't have a smartphone walking around where you could take HD video and, you know, the good pictures and all. but it's in the bed of my neighbor's truck. And I'm kind of holding it with one hand, holding my gun. He's kind of leaning over the and I love that he's in it, but I'm thinking, wow, that first buck, you know? What I could have done with those pictures, instead I've got, you know, this picture, which means a lot, but it could have been so much more.
Oh, yeah, yep.
My
first buck picture, I'm posed next to a 1983 Mercury Cougar with the trunk open because that's what I brought the deer home. a lot of regrets on some of those early hunting photos.
Oh, man. You know, it's I'm in a red and white flannel shirt and tiger stripe camo. I mean, I just thought, I look at that picture going, but, you know, I didn't know any better. And that's the whole reason you write this article. So people hear this, can do it better than we did it kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned lighting. Talk to us a minute about lighting.
Yeah, this was really the only kind of technical aspect of taking a photo that I touched on, because, well, really it's the most important. You see a lot of people, you know, a lot of photographs of deer are taken after dark.
Right.
And a lot of times they'll end up being poorly lit. Or you'll see, you know, daytime pictures where maybe the background's kind of bleached out because the sun was right in the background of the photo, or it's the sun's on the other side and it's throwing a shadow. You can't even see the hunter's face because of their cap. So
right.
Yeah, I did touch on just trying to get that lighting right. And a lot of times that's just, especially at night, it's getting as close to that person as you can with the camera. You're always better off to, rather using the zoom on your camera, you know, use your legs as your zoom, get as close
right.
to the subject as you can. That way, if you're using a flash, you know, it'll light up the subject better. Even during the day, you know, just try to position the person, look at what the sun's doing to your photo. You know, is it casting harsh shadows? You might need to turn the hunter and the deer a different direction. You might even want to use your flash during the day. A lot of times that can help, you know, fill in some of those shadows if their cap or whatever is throwing a shadow on their face. Turn the flash on and see if that, you know, doesn't help at least somewhat with those shadows.
Yeah, you know, it's for those of us who have a face made for radio, you know, the shadows from the cap's not a bad thing sometimes. but yeah, you see that in pictures too. And the last one is, I mean, especially if you have a young hunter, maybe first, second, nicest, you know, largest deer, or maybe one that's just special to the two of you or whatever. And I love it. Take it, end it, because this is a great way to end this article.
Yeah, you did. The last point I touched on was, you know, you didn't take enough pictures. And I've been guilty of this many times myself, but, you know, there's really no excuse anymore. When I first started killing deer myself and getting pictures, you know, just like we talked about, it was the old film cameras, take a few pictures and hope for the best, you know, take them in to get them developed. And if they didn't turn out well, you know, there was no going back.
Right.
But today it's so easy with, you know, everybody having good, I mean, the quality of our cell phone cameras is so much better than even, you know, digital cameras of just a few years ago. So you can get a great shot with your cell phone. You can instantly see, you know, what that photo looks like as soon as you take it. So if you take a lot of photos, try some different positions, different angles. It doesn't cost you anything whether whether you're taking one photo or 100, it doesn't cost you any more. So
that's right.
Take lots of photos, and you know that way, if some of them didn't turn out for whatever reason, you know, you should be able to. You take 100 photos, you should be able to get a few good ones
sure.
out of it. So,
sure.
You know, take the time to get plenty of photos, and as you're taking one, another thing I touched on is make sure, as you're taking those photos, it's easy just to glance at your phone or the screen and say, yeah, that looks good. But really zoom in, you know, once you've taken the photo, zoom in, make sure everything is good, crisp in focus, because it's hard to tell on a little cell phone screen. Mm-hmm. There's been plenty of times I've taken some photos and thought they looked great, and then you get them home on your actual computer and bring them up, and you're thinking, well, they're not, they're kind of fuzzy. They're not in good, crisp focus. So,
right.
Just, check those photos out as you're taking them and make sure you're getting a few good ones.
Well, this article you can find at the Quality Deer Management Association website, along with a lot of other articles Brian's written and all. Brian, in closing here a second, we were trying to set this up, and you mentioned you were taking your daughter hunting this weekend, and I have two daughters, and they've hunted with me. I've got a 12-year-old, so like my shadow these days when it comes to hunting. What, I guess your kids had no chance like mine did. When mom needs to do something and I'm going hunting, well, guess what? You're going hunting with me. What advice would you have for parents out there who are maybe contemplating, maybe not this season, but next season, or maybe they're thinking, well, they're old enough to go this season. What would you say to those parents or guardians or moms or whatever they're trying to get those kids involved in hunting?
Well, yeah, I do. I have two, and my daughter's actually 12 as well
wow.
I'll be taking this weekend. And they were involved at an early age. And I kind of I left it on them to decide, when they wanted to start getting involved. I never really pushed them into it. I didn't want to be, that parent that pushes their kids into all the sports or to do what I do. Of course, I certainly hope they would pick up hunting and enjoy it. But, I left it on them to decide when they wanted to get involved. And fortunately, they took an interest at an early age. But I think it's important to keep them involved. One, you got to keep it fun for them.
Okay.
Especially the younger kids. Their attention span's about 30 seconds, so you can't drag them out to the woods and expect them to sit perfectly still and quiet for 4 or 5 hours at a time.
Right.
So I would, early on, I would take a pop-up blind and we would sit in that. I'd let them pack, whatever coloring books or their Game Boy or whatever the case may be, so they wouldn't, just completely get bored out of their mind. And, just try to keep it fun for them. And, when they were ready to go, we would go, whether or not I was ready myself or not. So I think that's important. It's important to make sure they're outfitted properly. Make sure once you start taking them hunting, you want their equipment, whether it's a gun or bow, to fit them properly. You don't want your 8-year-old kid out there with a 300 Win Mag, tearing their shoulder off when they pull the trigger and scaring them to death.
Right.
You want them properly outfitted clothing wise. They're not going to, if they get out there every time and freeze to death, they're not going to want to go back. So, it's just important to, to make it fun, keep them comfortable. Don't push them, let them learn and go at their own pace. I try to provide them every opportunity I can. A lot of times that means sacrificing, my own time in the stand. But, to me, there's nothing like, seeing your kid, take their first deer or take a deer period.
Right.
My son killed a doe here a couple weeks ago. And he's killed deer before, but every time, I know I was shaking more than he was when that doe walked out. it tears me up, but, I love to see them involved and see them be successful.
Yeah, my 12-year-old, she's going for her first deer this year and had a couple of hunts and didn't see anything early in the season. And I was so proud of her because she had made I said, okay, what are your parameters? What are you going to do? She said, well, I'm not going to shoot anything that's got yearlings with it and has to be 4 points or better. So one of the last evening hunts we were on, I knew there were some deer in this field. We kind of stalked down the edge downwind, which was a good object lesson in itself. Here's how you get, if you want to move in on a deer, here's how you do it. It's a perfect setup. Got her to about 50 yards of a deer standing in, just facing away from us in the edge of the woods. And, she had the gun out ready to go. And as that deer turns broadside to her, I saw two little ones on the other side. And I said, Taylor, little ones. And I want you to know, she put the gun down. She goes, "That was really cool, Daddy." So it works. And you're right. When you have that kind of reaction from your kids, it doesn't matter if you're carrying a gun or not, because at that point, it's all about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings up a good point. Don't miss those teaching opportunities. There's so many while you're out there. Even if you're not seeing deer, there's just a lot of things you can kind of point out and talk to them about nature and conservation itself. You got their undivided attention
right.
When you're out there in the woods. So, take advantage of it. Some of the best conversations I've had with my kids have been, in the blind or in the deer stand. So.
Yep. You're right about that. Totally right. Well, Brian, I appreciate you coming on and giving me a few minutes of your time today. Like I said, folks, you can find more of Brian's articles and learn more about QDMA at the QDMA website and the magazine. And it's another one of those organizations, if you're conservation-minded, might be something you want to look at joining. Brian, I look forward to having you back on the show again someday.
All right. Thank you, Roger.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Appreciate you having me on.
Yes, sir. Talk to you soon. Welcome back to the final really, really, really short segment of Woods and Water South Carolina. I got to hand it to the Hurricanes archery team. They hosted 7 schools, Carolina Springs, Riverside, White Knoll, Chesney, Spartanburg, Whitmire, and J.O. Mann all came out to the Hurricanes archery tournament this past Saturday. Had 159 shooters, 450 people showed up. Just a great time. They're going to have another one on December the 9th. I'll keep you posted on that. If you're interested in high school, middle school archery, be a good thing for you to come out and look and see what these kids do. Got a great article about how good archery is for your exercise too. So anyway, thanks for tuning in. As always, make time to get out there. Take the back roads when you can. And like me, don't forget that camera. See you next week on More Woods and Water, South Carolina.
I'm gone, Carolina.